Shall we start? Let me apologize for starting a little late, 10 minutes late. I know that the minister has got another engagement. Not only did we receive an apology from him, but I also read about it in the Business Day yesterday, that he'll be having another meeting somewhere. So it's confirmed that you're not running away, but it was also in the media yesterday that you have to go and have a meeting with the Minister of Health and the Cabinet. All right, the copy of the agenda was circulated. Honourable Members, it is as tabled. In terms of the agenda, we are on item number one, which is opening. Shall we close our eyes and observe a moment of silence for prayer and meditation? Thank you. Let me greet the honourable members.
Sorry, Chair, just before you start, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to check if the minister is going to leave early, who will answer our clarifying questions or issues that we may have on the presentation one? And then number two, the presentation is around 29 slides. So if that is the case, that the minister will have to go early so that we can just go through the slides a little bit quicker so that we can have him here to answer anything that he needs to answer, any clarifying issue that we may have on the presentation. That is my request.
Okay, I know it came before the apologies. Shall we keep it until we get to that item? I'm sure the Honourable Minister will be able to give us clarity on the matters that you have raised. Is that okay? All right. I was still saying, still greeting the Honourable Members, the Honourable Minister and the entire National Treasury team. I'd like to also greet the staff, all stakeholders, and all guests present here this morning. You are all very welcome. I wish to welcome you all to this important meeting wherein we will receive a briefing from the National Treasury on the 2017 Appropriation Bill. A special word of welcome is extended to the Honorable Minister who is meeting with the committee for the very first time, but also would like to take this opportunity and congratulate you for your appointment. We're looking forward to a very, very good and strong working relationship. Well, as honourable members will know, this is the fourth appropriation bill to be processed by the fifth parliament, the second last one before this term of parliament concludes. That's how serious it is. We also know that progress in attaining the NDP and MTSF targets, as the DPME has confirmed in our meeting last week, is not where it should be. In addition, within the current difficult fiscal context, it is imperative that all activities planned on the 2017 budget must, and I repeat, must be done. And they must be done effectively and efficiently. It is thus our responsibility as this committee to ensure that our limited resources are allocated to those areas where the radical transformation of our society and rapid inclusive growth of our economy have the best possibility of being realized in this financial year. Therefore, honorable members, I really would once again thank you for coming, but also to emphasize that I'm looking forward to a robust and a fruitful engagement between ourselves and Treasury. Let's have free, open, and constructive discussions. I thank you. Honorable members, I will then move on to item number 2, which is apologies. Are there any apologies?
Chairperson, we haven't received any apologies from the committee members. The only apology is from the Minister of Finance, who states that he needs to leave the meeting at about 10:30. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Fink indicated that he'd be late. His flight was delayed. He will be here as soon as he can.
I have also received an SMS from Honourable Member Gwabaza, who is the whip of the committee, who will be joining the meeting late. He's also running late. He's coming through from KZN this morning. Okay. Any other apology? Okay. Honourable Members, we have received the apologies, and now I would like to put it to you on whether you accept the apologies or not. Honourable Member Imam?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I move for the acceptance of the apologies.
Any seconder? Any seconder? Seconded. All right. I know there was an earlier intervention by Honourable Member Dlamwini. I would like Treasury maybe to respond to those issues that were raised by Honourable Member Dlamwini, but if maybe you want her to repeat the questions, you can say something before you do you have the questions that she raised earlier on. Would you like her to repeat the question? Could you please repeat your questions? I'm sorry for that, Honourable Member.
I was asking, Chair, if the Minister is going to leave at 10:30, if there's any clarifying issues that we may have on the presentation, who will answer that? And because we note it's his first time and he's going to leave at 10:30, so we have him for 30 minutes, and the presentation slide is 29 minutes. Of 29 slides. So that is my question. Who will be able to give me correspondence if there's any?
Thank you, Honourable Member, for your question. Then to the Treasury. Honourable Minister would like to come in.
Yes, thank you. Chair, the DDG heading the budget office and the team are here. They will be able, they are quite competent to answer all the questions. They have been involved in the formulation of both the budget as well as the appropriation bid. So they are quite competent to respond to all the questions that will be asked. Thank you. And if there are any questions that are required, particularly of me, there are parliamentary procedures towards that effect, and I will make sure to answer all of those questions when they are written and sent to my office. Thank you.
Now, on the presentation, it's very long. I know that we've asked departments to try and find a way, you know, of giving us a short and focused, very straightforward presentation. Do you have that for us?
Chairperson, I don't intend to go through the detail of all of the slides.
Okay, you've talked to
and I will try and make it as concise as possible. Some of them are more like background information.
Okay. Now, thank you so much. We now are aware of the procedure that we will be following at this committee. And indeed, if you can be short, I think for one or two questions for the minister, I'm sure we can then allow the minister to respond to the board. It can just be short so that we prioritize those that indeed need a response by the minister himself, and then we then allow the other discussion to flow after that. Thank you very much. We will then move to item number 3, which is presentation by National Treasury. Honorable Minister, I'm sure you would want to give us some little summary, you know, so if we hear from you, remember this committee hasn't heard from you and would like to hear your voice, and After that, then we proceed with this. Over to the Honourable Minister.
Thank you, Chair. I must thank you for a warm welcome, and I convey my greetings to the members of the committee. I look forward to working with the committee on the work that is ahead of us. I think, bearing in mind the need to try and go through the presentation, one would want to say we are in interesting times when we have to try and pursue growth and transformation, inclusive growth, in an environment of a very tight fiscal position. Our level of economic growth is quite low, and though we saw an improvement last year and expect a further improvement this year, it is still not sufficient to ensure sustainable growth in employment, sustainable reduction in poverty and inequality, and a substantive involvement, particularly of black people, women, youth, and poor communities in economic activities. And it's also not sufficient to substantially increase our revenue base so that we can grow the fiscal. And so the budget process that we are undertaking reflects those difficulties and the difficult choices and trade-offs that must be made in trying to balance between the varying needs of different constituencies. But the budget also reflects some choices that we are making. On the one hand, to use the budget to redistribute resources and incomes, paying attention to the poor and working people through continuing to spend in social and basic services in a manner that will ensure that the poor are not further marginalized and don't drop further into poverty. But we also make a choice to invest in the economy through supporting tourism, SMMEs, supporting the ocean's economy through Operation Pakisa, supporting agriculture. We take note of the fact that we have those difficult choices to make. We must maintain the fiscal framework whilst continuing to use the budget to drive economic growth. It's going to be a tight balance, and we are committed to ensuring that we maintain that balance at all times amidst many social pressures that we will come across. It's important, therefore, that the process of finalizing the appropriations bill be undertaken with that framework, with that context in mind. Because at the end of the day, what we would hope to achieve is to continue paying greater and urgent attention to growing the economy in an inclusive manner, which would give us greater options in the future going forward, so that we don't focus ourselves narrowly on simply managing the current budget as it is. We want it to grow, and for it to grow, to enable us to do more, we would need to pay attention to matters of inclusive growth. And that's the area that we will be paying attention to during the course of the year and in the coming years. And that is why the budget provides that support for SMMEs for infrastructure rollout. Towards that effect, we would want to continue paying attention and perhaps increase the attention we pay to the efficiency of state-owned companies, their ability to spend, their ability to improve their governance processes, to improve their financial health and fulfill their developmental mandate. At the same time, we will also continue to pay attention working with our other sister departments to pay attention to issues of improving the capacity of the public service to build a developmental public service that is professional, that delivers services, that delivers on their mandate, and ensure that government is able to spend efficiently and prudently the resources that have been allocated for various programs. I think as at where we stand now, a lot of work, we are quite a distance down the road of budget spend in terms of the various divisions of revenue have been presented in provinces, municipalities have presented their budgets, IDPs in many instances have been developed or are in the process of finalization. So we have a distance that's been covered and we need to pay that attention to ensuring that the appropriation bill is therefore concluded on time so that we are able to carry forward the programs that we intend carrying forward. We will also continue to modernize and improve the procurement processes within the state so that through them we are able to pursue transformation and at the same time to cap all to cap inefficiency and other inappropriate processes and spend our procurement budget in a manner that's going to enhance the objective of transformation and growth in the economy, support new SMMEs and cooperatives and other such sectors. But I think when we present the presentation, will address all of those issues and the steps that we are taking towards that effect. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Honourable Minister, for your overview. We will then request the DDG to take us through the presentation. Honourable Members, let's listen carefully so that we can constructively engage with the presentation.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and let me also just take note that we've also been joined by DDG Mokhajan, who is the responsible for public finance. But
before you proceed, may I also inform the committee now that we are here that the DG, as you know, officially retired. Well, not retired, but he resigned yesterday, and so we have appointed Dondo as the acting DG, pending the finalization of the recruitment process for a new Director General. I must also inform the committee that we are interviewing this afternoon, and we hope that by the end of the month, we will have taken through cabinet the the recommendation for the appointment of a new DG. I thought it was an important update to provide to the committee. Thank you.
For the additional information, it is indeed important.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The letter requesting this briefing included quite a wide range of topics that you were interested in being briefed on. And we've tried to, as far as possible, address those, but obviously, given the time constraints, I will rush through some of them. I think this first slide is really repeating when we tabled the Appropriation Act or bill in February. This was how we articulated the relationship between transformation and growth. And I think just the first bullet is really the most important thing, that we have a constitution that requires governments to achieve a rising floor of social and economic rights for the population. And that implies that the economy would expand, and particular per capita income is what I would think is required. And unfortunately, over the last 3 years, we have seen per capita income decline in South Africa. Population growth is about 1.5%. So whenever economic growth falls below 1.5%, it means average income is declining. And the point we're making in that first bullet is that in order to reignite the process of growth, we need transformation of the economy. So we don't see transformation as opposed to economic growth, but actually transformation is the tool through which economic growth needs to be reignited. As the Minister has indicated on the second slide, the projected rate of economic growth is insufficient to reduce unemployment, inequality, and poverty. The budget is highly redistributive, but stronger economic growth is required to sustain the fiscal position. What do we need to do to get onto a path of stronger growth? Firstly, transforming patterns of asset ownership and production, promoting competition, and deconcentrating product markets. So if we have a highly concentrated sector in the economy dominated by monopolies or oligopolies, we want to open up that sector precisely so that new investment can be injected into that particular sector, which again is the objective of transformation that we're trying to pursue. Also, mobilizing private and public capital investment in tandem to help modernize and diversify the economy, providing workers and the poor with access to markets and social and economic infrastructure, strengthening transparent government and the rule of law, investing in research and development, and improving the quality of education and training. Now, already the budget contributes to offsetting the problems that we have in our private economy. So we all know we're amongst the most unequal economies in the world, and the budget plays a critical role in offsetting the inequities associated with that. So this graph, which appeared in the budget review, is just dividing the population into three groups according to their wealth, according to the income they earn in the market. So the top 10% of South Africans, and then the middle 40% of South Africans, and the bottom 50% by wealth. And the graph is showing that taxes, and this excludes corporate tax, but it includes PIT, personal income tax, VAT, and fuel levies and other taxes. That top 10% of the population in terms of wealth pays about 72% of the taxes we collect. That's the gray bars, whereas the bottom 50% pays only 4% of the taxes we collect, mainly through excise on cigarettes and alcohol and VAT. But the spending is distributed in the opposite direction. So the bottom 50% get about 50% of government spending. So it's just important to bear in mind that already the budget is highly redistributive. Also on this slide, we show how that distribution, redistribution is carried out through the equitable share and conditional grants we give to provinces and municipalities. So the graph on the left-hand side shows that a province like Gauteng receives an equitable share about 6,500 rand per resident, per person, whereas its neighbor, Limpopo, receives 9,000 rand per person, which is embedded in the formula of the equitable share and is an indication of how redistributive that process is. Also, on the right-hand side, you see the situation with regards to local government. Metros, big metropolitan municipalities, on average, receive an equitable share about 2,000 rand per household resident in the metro, whereas the rural municipalities receive about 5,600 rand per household. The next slide, I think, is critical and important, but I will not go through it in great detail except to say it's always important to understand the difference between the consolidated budget and the main budget. And in the main budget, what are you appropriating? Because there's a budget, and then there's an appropriation act, and the two are not the same, because the budget is much broader than the appropriation act. The equitable share that goes to provinces is not part of the appropriation act. Debt service costs are not part of the appropriation act. The salaries of MPs and members of the executive, the president and the deputy president, are not part of the appropriation act. These are all direct charges that are subtracted, that are part of the budget, but Parliament doesn't appropriate on. And maybe the next slide is really explaining the situation. The critical issue is that the Constitution establishes a national revenue fund, and it says that all revenue that government receives must be deposited into that fund. It's a bank account, and all of our income has to go into that bank account. And there's only two ways that we can withdraw resources from that bank account. One is by appropriation. In other words, Parliament enacts law that allows us to remove the funds from the National Revenue Fund, or through a direct charge, which is either mandated directly by the Constitution, as in the case of the provincial equitable share, or by national legislation, which applies to things like the skills levy. So the Appropriation Act gives effect to this constitutional mandate and gives permission to the executive to take out money from the National Revenue Fund and use it for specific purposes. The budget is not determined by the executive. The budget is determined by the legislature, and as you know, you have those powers to amend the budget. So continuing, as you're aware, the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act requires that after the tabling of the national budget, Parliament must within 16 days submit a report on the fiscal framework and the division of revenue proposals. And then we pass the Division of Revenue Bill no longer than 35 days after the adoption of the fiscal framework. And then we must adopt the appropriation bill. It is not an accident. This sequence is not an accident. It's very deliberate. That when we first make a decision about how much we have, and that is what is in the fiscal framework, the revenue and expenditure levels available. We then make a decision about how we're going to divide that fund between the three spheres of government. And only when we've made those two decisions do we come to the last decision, which is the appropriation decision, which is the piece that is left over for national government. How is it to be appropriated? Because the other parts that go to the other provinces, to the provinces, are appropriated in their own provincial legislatures. So this sequence is very important. And as you, as Parliament, consider, which I know particularly in the Finance Committee, it's a very strong issue. As you consider amendments to this Money Bills Amendment Procedure, it's important to bear in mind this important sequence, because we don't want to get into a situation where we start budgeting by adding up what everybody needs and then seeing what the total is. Rather, we need to make a macroeconomic and fiscal choice about how much we're prepared to spend, how much we're going to fund that from revenue, how much we're going to fund that from debt. And only after we've done that do we then get into the business of saying, how do we divide that pie between different people or different functions? So just so that you're aware, there is a time constraint. We are into the next fiscal year. Up to the end of July, because you haven't yet passed the Appropriation Act, departments continue to spend on the basis of last year's budget. And they can spend up to 45% of last year's budget up to the end of July. And thereafter, they can spend 10%. So until we pass the Appropriation Act, we haven't really given legal weight to what was tabled by the executive. And I think that's pretty clear. It's important when you look at the appropriation bill, again, this is mandated by the PFMA and the Constitution, that it divides all of the monies we're going to appropriate into a vote and a main division within a vote, which is a program. And those allocations are then categorized in terms of certain accounting requirements or accounting definitions. Current payments, compensation, goods and services, and interest and rent on land, transfers and subsidies, and payments to capital assets. And it's important it becomes quite complicated because in looked at from a certain point of view, something can be infrastructure spending, which would be under payments for capital assets. But looked at from another point of view, it will be transfers and subsidies. So, for example, there's a table later. Maybe let me just go there quickly. Where we say infrastructure expenditure estimates, and the biggest one there is transport. And it says that in 2017-18 there's $41 billion or thereabouts to be spent on transport infrastructure. But if you go to the Department of Transport votes, you will not see, I think the capital spending there is about $2 billion. Then you think, but what's going on? And the reason is that the Department of Transport does not spend on infrastructure. It transfers money to SANRAL and it transfers money to PRASA. And those two agents, so on their budgets it appears as capital spending, but on the vote it appears as transfers and subsidies. So these are things that are there for a good reason but make life a bit complicated. Also note the asterisks, if that's the right collective noun, that things marked with an asterisk, we are proposing that Parliament make them specifically and exclusively appropriated. And that means that the Department has to spend that budget line only on that element. What we've done last year and what we're proposing to do this year, usually it's the case that specifically and exclusively appropriated is something that Parliament is very committed to. A particular grant that must be spent, say, on building schools, that you can't shift that money into anything else simply through an administrative procedure within Treasury. You have to actually come back to Parliament if you want to shift that money. What we've done last year and what we're proposing to do again this year is specifically and exclusively appropriate compensation budgets, not per program, but per vote. So let's take the Department of Corrections. Last year, the adjustment budget, we faced an economic crunch, and Cabinet took a decision that budgets would have to be lowered in year. And we were also facing a significant crunch around compensation budgets in particular. People couldn't afford to pay their compensation budgets. But in that year, the Department of Corrections downwardly revised, adjusted their compensation budget by R1 billion in the middle of the year. And if you look in history, and I don't want to single them out, I've just used that was the biggest example in my mind of recent years. But many departments have quite generous compensation budgets. And in the middle of the year, they shift those resources to some other use that they have in mind for those resources. So to put a stop to that and to require departments to take budgeting more seriously, we've said let's make those compensation budgets specifically and exclusively appropriated. So departments, if they want to increase their compensation budget or if they want to decrease it, they will have to come and speak to Parliament. They can't do it because if it's not specifically and exclusively appropriated, Treasury can basically, Dondo is the head of public finance, can just through a letter, right, sign that the money should be shifted. As colleagues are, I'm sure, are painfully aware, we have these big documents which set out a lot of information, and there's even more on the website. For each vote, there's even extra information there, and I won't go through all of that. I think on the NDP and the MTSF, you would have seen in recent days that the Minister of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation has indicated that we're trying to seek more alignment between the budget process and the NDP and the MTSF. They're working on what we call a mandate paper, which will go to Cabinet Lekhotla, that will help guide the allocation of resources. It's important to begin thinking about the fact that the budget we're going to table next year will be for the last year of the current MTSF, because the current one is 2014 to 2019. And we need to begin bearing in mind the process of even preparing a new one. This graph is just showing you, again, one needs to be very careful when looking at numbers in the budget. And these numbers are dealing with the appropriations. So it's not the entire consolidated budget, just the appropriations, but they show you, for the last few years we've had an expenditure ceiling, so we haven't added anything to expenditure. But each year that we go through the budget process, we reallocate spending from one, what here we're looking at function groups, one policy objective to another. And you can see there that, and I think, Raquel, this is MTEF, this is over the next 3 years, we've reallocated significant resources into post-school education and training. Part of those resources, if you look at, and I mean, this is where we need to understand that in a context of an expenditure ceiling, this reallocation is a zero-sum game. So that additional resources that have gone to higher to post-school education have come from somewhere, and you can see it's come from human settlements and municipal infrastructure, social protection a bit, and general public services. This is just a summary of some of the budget allocations that we think are contributing to the economic growth and development objectives we have. And I think, Chair, I've probably said everything that I need to say. These slides where we look at, for example, basic education, in the first chapter of the E&E, there's a detailed accounting per vote of how we've shifted funds within and between those votes. And some of the questions that might, so it looks like 2.6 billion is allocated for the school infrastructure backlog grant, but if you look at the table in the introductory chapter, you will see that that was actually just a shift from the education infrastructure grant. So the money is still there for the same purpose. The only issue is it a conditional grant going to provinces or a grant administered by the National Department of Education? So I won't go through all of these remaining slides, and I think I will stop there. Thank you, in the interest of time.
I think one interesting one that I really wanted to go through, that one of the reduction of expenditure ceiling. I think we need deeper understanding on that one, so that when members interact with departments, they should move from an informed position.
Thanks, Chair. So, obviously, we've been facing fiscal constraints, and when we're sitting here on appropriations, we're only looking at the expenditure side, but it's important to bear in mind that there's expenditure reduction and revenue enhancement that is taking place. And in general, what we try to do is to postpone the expenditure reduction to future years. because if you implement an expenditure, it's much more, it's kind of easy. I mean, some members, honourable members, may disagree with me, but from an administrative point of view, it's quite easy to increase a tax. You just change a tax rate and people pay. But from an expenditure side, you want to give departments time to plan with a new lower expenditure baseline, because then they can implement it more efficiently. So we have in previous years reduced spending in 17, 18, and 18, 19 by, let's say, 10 billion and 16 billion. Those reductions were distributed across the three spheres of government, but in the main fell on national and provincial. So I think a bit more than half affects the Appropriation Act, the national appropriations. Note that although we're reducing the expenditure limit, expenditure is still growing in aggregate terms. We're not reducing expenditure year after year. And there you can see you've got 1.25 trillion this year. The plan for next year is 1.34 trillion and then 1.45 trillion. It's reduced relative to the plans we previously had, but it is still increasing in real terms, just about. So if you look, and I would refer members to Chapter 5 of the budget review, which gives much more detail than this presentation on how we achieve these expenditure reductions. There were revised projections of social grant beneficiaries, for example. That is simply almost an accounting or an administrative projection of how many children do we think are coming onto the system, and it's revised from time to time. It was revised upwards significantly in the last budget round, but the actual performance of the system shows that that upward revision was probably too much. So this budget, we revised it down again, and that's kind of a technical process. We did also reduce baselines of national departments. We tried to focus those baseline reductions on goods and services budgets. And we excluded large departments with major pressures on their compensation budgets were excluded from that process, such as the police. There is something that we've introduced in the last couple of years that is detailed in Chapter 5 that is called provisional allocations. And this is where we allocate in the budget, but we don't assign an amount of money to a baseline in the E&E. So, for example, we had been going through a process of reviewing industrial incentives. There was a program we introduced about 2011, which was an industrial incentive program, and we said it would last for 6 years. It was coming to an end in 2017. Then we would say, let's not take it out of the budget, but let's add that money provisionally. When we came to the next budget round and the economic circumstances have changed, in fact, not in that example, but in some other examples, we withdrew those provisional allocations. And all of this is detailed, as I say, in Chapter 5. Also, we do have contingency reserves. So when we reduce the expenditure ceiling, for example, in the current year, we have 6 billion. I think next year we have 10 billion. And the outer year, we have 20 billion. In the current framework. So when we reduce the expenditure ceiling, that's the first place we look, is the contingency reserve, which we would like to keep for contingencies, but sometimes it's less painful to reduce that than it is to reduce budgets. So in terms of those accounting definitions, you can see how was these reductions distributed. Transfers and subsidies, including conditional grants, were a large reduction. There was a large reduction in some of the conditional grants going, for example, to housing in provinces. Goods and services budgets were also reduced, and compensation budgets were reduced a bit more. As far as possible, we tried to keep away from capital assets, but that's what we ended up with. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much for the insightful presentation. Honourable members, I see the Honourable Minister is still here, and thank you so much for being considerate, you know, especially for the members' request earlier on. I will only allow 5 questions for the minister, and thereafter I think the minister can then go and attend to his other duties. Five questions, and when you ask, please be short and to the point. Only five questions. Thank you very much. First person, Honourable Member Shopet Tole, Honourable Member Imam, Honourable Member Dr. Peek. If there's no other person, I'll also ask a question. All right, thanks. In that order.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I just want to congratulate the Minister. And I must tell you that I'm really upbeat. I've been following everything that you have said everywhere, including yesterday. And I'm very happy. And I'm impressed by the fact that you are talking about focusing on the history. Because there's no way we can effect transformation if we don't put our eye on the effect of the history from which we come from. So I just want to congratulate you. I'll ask the questions from the department itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member Schottenstein, Honourable Member
Simon. Thank you, Chair. Let me thank Treasury for their presentation. My question to the Minister, amongst a whole lot of, but I think one very important that we have identified at this committee over a period of time, Minister, that we appropriate departments, provincial, national, all come with their strategic plans, which we've already uncovered that they don't really apply their minds to. They just come with strategic plans because they want the resources to be made available. However, resources are made available to them. And then we find there's a serious problem. And that is they either underspent or they irregularly spent. As a result thereof, we find that they're not doing justice to that radical economic transformation because monies that have been earmarked for service delivery on the ground is not being used accordingly. And what we found, Minister, is that all of us are frustrated. Treasury is frustrated. The Auditor General is frustrated. Because we've got structure over structure over structure over structure, but nothing happens because every single structure can only recommend. And that's where it stops and the matter closes. As a result thereof, we find that a great percentage of the work that we are being done is really a futile exercise if we can't get people to perform and do their jobs and do it properly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. My question is regarding the slide on... the slide on page 5, where you deal with the number of households and the per capita. Now, just for clarification, which survey of number of households and number of individuals was used to determine the allocation for this budget? Thank you.
Some of the procurement reforms are meant to increase opportunity for black women, youth, people with disabilities, for operating, military veterans, and suppliers from rural communities. What more can be done in this budget? So these are the five questions. So we will then hand over to the Honourable Minister and the Minister of Peace to respond.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start with just a brief comment on the question by Honourable Shobhis Tole. You know, part of the difficulty we sit with in South Africa is that we keep referring to the historically disadvantaged. Conceptually, that term presupposes that or may be interpreted to mean that those that were disadvantaged in history no longer are now. But I think the statistics that we deal with indicate the stubborn persistence of that disadvantage. If you look at the Oxfam report estimating that just 3 South African billionaires own wealth equivalent to the bottom half of the population, that these 3 citizens, therefore, if you put this in figures, they own more wealth than 28 million other South Africans combined. 1%, the richest 1% of the population owns 42% of the wealth. The top 10% of the population owns 95% of the wealth. Now, this is, I think, an indictment that we need to pay attention to today as urgently as possible if we are to sustain the growth and the stability we have achieved in the last 23 years. And I say we need to pay attention to this urgently so that we don't find ourselves compelled by circumstances beyond our control to have to intervene or to follow spontaneous self-corrective measures. And I think that this is what we should unite around. It's what we should unite around, not only as members of parliament or as government, but also as the political business, labor, and civil society role players. There is a greater need for all of the social partners to work together to find solutions to these problems. And they speak not only to the need to create employment, they speak also to the need to create assets for those who are without assets, to create economic opportunities for those who wish to become entrepreneurs and industrialists, and to ensure that not only are they provided with opportunity to access economic assets, but they are also assisted with all sorts of access to supply chains, to logistics infrastructure, in order for their initiatives to have any possibility for success. And I think the debate in South Africa should really focus on those initiatives. And I think we have begun to see a movement towards that effect in the discussions between business and government, the initiatives that have been that are being agreed to, including support for SMME development through the establishment of the SME Fund, the various partnerships and coalitions that are being forged and that we need to forge between the state-owned companies and various industrial sectors in the country, such as the automotive sector, the mining sector, the agricultural sector, including emerging miners and emerging farmers, so that they can have a possibility to play a role in the economy and contribute towards creating wealth and supporting the inclusive growth story that we are talking about. The question asked by Honorable Imam addresses itself to an important issue of accountability. The need to for us to continue building what the NDP refers to as a capable state, but in particular to build a developmental public service. So we need an interface between a conscientious political leadership at the level of the executive, whether at national or provincial or even municipal levels, and the public service, so that we deal with these problems of underspending, irregular spending, because in large measure, They relate to some gaps in the system. For example, you may decide on infrastructure rollout, but the condition could be that you require certain approvals prior to even starting with the implementation of projects, and you find delays at that level. Now, for us to focus only on those who are supposed to implement the project without looking at those who are supposed to provide the approvals required for the project to commence may be inappropriate in itself. And so as we pursue the task of government and delivery, we need to create the institutional infrastructure that assists us to pay attention to all of these issues. The Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Committee, in part, was meant to address some of these loopholes. And it came as a significant in institutional infrastructure to support the implementation of the physical infrastructure program. But we need to develop requisite capacity for us to achieve that interface that will ensure that we reduce the time it takes between agreeing on a project and actually implementing it, especially when funding for that project is there. And I think there are examples elsewhere in the world where, in countries such as Southeast Asia, where such challenges were able to be resolved. But broadly speaking, and even with regard to other aspects of government programs that have been agreed, we do need to pay attention to that capability at the state level to be able to spend within budget, spend timeously, avoid irregular spending or cost overrun at times in terms of the programs and projects that have been agreed to, and to agree on accountability mechanisms for us to be able to deal with those issues. Let me jump, Chair, and answer your question. I'm sure Mike will address himself to the question Dr. Fick asked. The chairperson asked about, I mean, well, the others were statements that I agree with, that we need timeous interventions with regard to the programs for accelerated inclusive growth, and that in that regard, there is a need for us to develop. I know that the Minister of Small Business Development has spoken to me about a program for township economy development. In Gauteng, as we speak, there is a summit focusing on that. There are various projects that are being implemented across the country, the Bridge City, Ethekwini Municipality, the Dube Trade Port. The department, the National Treasury itself, has a city support program, which has looked at about seven to nine projects around the country in different provinces that we seek to support. And I think it's an area we need to really develop integrated strategies towards, link it with the infrastructure rollout program, and further find partnerships with the private sector to unlock their investments, their balance sheet, to support the development of social and economic infrastructure in our townships, to build the township economy on the basis of productive economic activity. I think most of our townships at the present moment suffer from a number of challenges that, among others, which include that there is no productive economic activity. The type of economic activity taking place in most of our townships is quite menial. There is no sufficient or requisite infrastructure connection between the townships and the cities, the CBDs. The public service, I mean the government services, are largely not found in the township. So you find most of the people who live in townships suffering from the 40 by 40 by 40 syndrome, living in 40 square meter houses, 40 or more minutes away from the city, and spending 40% of their MIEKA incomes on transport to the city. Now, in addition to that, you know, if I use the experience of where I come from, just over a month ago, very few departments, I mean, very few townships in the country have home affairs offices. So people are forced to leave the township and come to town if they seek government services. And so they must spend their incomes coming to the city. So even if you build economic activity in the township, we were asking them at the Bridge City, that intersection between KwaMashu and Tuzuma Inanda, but are there government services here? Yes, there are plans, there is a court, there are plans to establish a government mall which would have different departments providing services there. But if that were not there, so the people in those townships would remain compelled to come to town to seek government services. And therefore people must make a choice whether you want to go do your groceries at the shops for the shopping center in the township when you still have to go to town to seek government services. And then they decide, let me just go to town and do everything at once and come back. And by so doing, including the fact that in town, that is where they work, they then find themselves unable to support the shops and other retail outlets in the township, which means that those outlets are not going to grow. These are strategic and urgent decisions we need to make, and I think that if we are talking about inclusive growth, the same would apply to rural areas. I've deliberately left rural areas out in these examples I'm making, but the same would apply, and actually even worse. Because even as we speak, there is a movement of people towards urban areas. And it's not only Africa that is the most urbanizing continent in the world, but South Africa itself, a large part of our population now lives in the cities than in rural areas. So these are areas, issues that we need to pay attention to if we are to talk inclusive growth and look at how we use the procurement reforms process to effect change deliberately in all of those areas. And I think the focus, much as this is going, it's an ambitious program, it's going to be taxing in terms of financial and human resources, but we must not only focus on national government, because this 500 billion rand procurement spend we are talking about is only government spend. We have not begun talking about aligning the procurement expenditure of state-owned companies, which far exceeds the government procurement spend. We have not begun talking about how we align it to achieve the same objective, so that even in regards to our state-owned companies, and perhaps particularly in regards to them, we use their infrastructure and operational spend as a lever to drive the Black Industrialist Program to support our SMMEs. If you look at countries like your Italy and other countries in the EU, their cooperatives are involved in infrastructure rollout, in renewable energy, in freight logistics, and many of them even invest abroad, including in South Africa. Now, we have an opportunity to use that lever to change both the structure of production and the patterns of ownership in the economy, and I think that's what we need to pay attention to. How will we achieve all of this within a whilst maintaining the fiscal framework? I think that we need to be pragmatic and realistic. It means that we must bite what we can chew. And that's why it becomes important for us to pay attention to growing the economy, growing our revenue base, and growing the fiscal, so that on a gradual basis we can increasingly do all of these things that we wish to achieve. But I don't think that we need to focus only on government. That's why I was saying we need a developmental public service. We need developmental boards in state-owned companies that think in terms of the developmental mandate and how they align their own resources in pursuit of that mandate, so that we don't put the heavy weight of transforming the country on government alone. We all take responsibility and work towards the same objective in pretty much the same way as your Southeast Asian countries and even China have been able to do with their development priorities. Thank you, Chair. I think other questions the team will then respond to. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. The Honourable Minister would like to be excused. He's already submitted an earlier written apology on his other commitment in Cabinet, where he's got to receive a report from NHI and the preparations and the budget. What is it? Estimates. These are estimates, budget estimates for that program. I'm sure you all understand because this year is the year for the implementation of the NHI. So, honorable members, I think you are happy. We can release the honorable minister, am I right? Okay. Honorable minister, thank you so much for coming. We know that you've got a very tight schedule. But then the expectation in committees is that at least we should have the minister attending to account. But then in the eventuality when you can't make it, we will appreciate if you can send your deputy minister. Okay, thank you so much. The honorable minister is released. All right, thank you so much. And then we continue with the business of this meeting. Remember, I did speak about robust but constructive engagement. That will take the work of this committee, but also the work of this department forward. Over to the, by the way, you're still responding to some of the questions here. There's one question that has got to be responded to, and then I give you another round of another bite in your questions to the treasurer.
Just on the question of the underlying data for these graphs, when we allocate the equitable share and other parts of the budget that we divide amongst other spheres of government, it's all done on the basis of official statistics coming from Stats South Africa. So there's the 2016 community survey, there's updates each year based on the 2011 census, and other official data from South Africa. So that's the basis. I don't know if Steve wants to add anything.
Okay. Honorable members, the only follow-up questions?
Honourable Chair, thank you. Yes, I understand that, but what I wanted to know is just to make sure that the allocation is accurate. This allocation, which data was used? In other words, which year? Was it the 2016 or was it 2011? That was my question. Thank you.
The 2016 community survey. To answer this question. In the budget review, maybe Michael can in the meantime look for the page, we have indicated that we want to step up our engagement and we want to actually ramp up how we engage with departments in a way that we actually begin to dig deeper into how the department performs on budget, and secondly, how they actually make sure that the budgets are addressed in terms of Honourable Imam's question earlier. So, and that's across all sectors, including this sector and spending insofar as ICT-related expenditure is concerned. There's one key reform that's critical that government must still finalize and articulate itself on. That's issues around spectrum allocation. Meaning it will, obviously by just releasing spectrum out there, will actually ensure that there's benefits in terms of accessing information, connecting schools, connecting hospitals, connecting all government services that the minister was talking about earlier,
And that in itself will have a huge economic benefit, and spin-offs obviously will be realized. Economic spin-offs will be realized. So I think the big challenge we have for us is to make sure that issue is addressed. One is to also ensure with the Department of Communications and Department of Telecommunication and Postal Services and the entities that are empowered to actually do this, that and obviously ensure that with necessary private sector players, that we are able to ensure that we partner in rolling out ICT in terms of what government and what the NDP is all about. So, Michael, that section, did you pick it up in terms of how we want to step up our services? And
I think, first of all, we did cite some research in the budget review that a 50% reduction in ICT costs could increase GDP growth by 0.3 percentage points and create an additional 200,000 additional jobs over the next decade. So this is a concrete example of when we say we need transformation in order to generate economic growth. This is one area where we're talking. So, as honourable members will know, there have been delays. DDG Mokhojani spoke about the spectrum allocation, and in partly that is contingent on the migration of the television broadcast system, which, as honourable members are aware, has been delayed. But so there's been a bit of delays. There is a program in government to expand access to high-speed internet to low-income households, and in the current MTEF, there's about $2 billion allocated to broadband over the medium term, and the Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services plans to connect more than 6,000 schools and public buildings to internet services at a speed of 10 megabits per second by 2020. So there is a program. It has been delayed a bit. There's also been a policy process that probably took longer than it should have, but hopefully it will be all steam ahead now.
But then, if you say by 2020, that's not far. I think this committee will appreciate a plan of action. So if you can't say 2020 and then we wait for 2020, we want to see how are you going to eat this elephant so that come 2020, it's eaten up. Does it make sense? Yes,
it makes sense, Honourable Chair, but with the one proviso that we would want to come with that plan together with the relevant department as Treasury. So because we wouldn't be the right experts on this one.
That will assist, because I think by the end of 2014 there was already a plan for implementation. And the emphasis was that would be the key project for this MTSF medium term strategic framework. And we are now at 2017. We're still talking implementation. That's why we say, remember, we are on this, we are in this radical socio-economic transformation phase. I think we need some radicalism in terms of implementation so that come 2020, we have it. We're not talking implementation, because we've been talking implementation from time immemorial. So let's have a broken down plan, and then with that department, and then so that at least we finish the story. We cannot be talking, giving a narrative without the actual impact or implementation of this narrative. Honourable Member Shoko Tole.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to follow up a little bit on what the Chairperson has said. The delays. Where is our challenge? Is it because people are not given permission to do that, which they must do, as the minister has alluded to, or is it because people are not ready to implement? financially? What is the problem?
See, now I'm more inclined on outcome. No longer focusing on the process. But for too long, now we want to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to be as brief as I can. Since SONA this year, this expression, radical economic transformation, has been the latest buzzword. It's said a lot, but I haven't had anybody yet say what it actually means. What are we doing that's going to be radically different to what we did in the past? I understand what the word economic means. You yourself speak of socio-economic transformation, but whether it's socio-economic or economic, I don't think it's really germane to the issue. And what are we transforming from and to? Are we transforming from what we did last year or 5 years ago? And what are we actually aiming at? The word transformation would indicate you're going from one thing to another. So what are we moving from and to? It's not clear in my mind what we're doing. We keep talking about radical economic transformation, but can I have some... Maybe Treasury can assist me to actually understand what they mean by this. Thank you, Madam.
I know the Honourable Minister tried to unpack that, but the acting DG show will expand on that. The next, Honourable Member Snukwanyan.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you for the presentation from Treasury. Quite informative and helpful. And I must say that the mammoth task that you are actually faced with in view of the available finances of sort of budget rather than finances. But I just want to speak to this issue of trying to promote a strong and inclusive growth. Just to check, get a sense of, do you find that the private sector is really coming on board? What role is the private sector coming in? Because as part of transformation, I think that is one area that personally I would imagine that would play a very important role if people are prepared to come on board. And then the other thing is the issue of the SOEs. These enterprises were established for a purpose, but currently, even from the presentation, it's very clear that we are not moving in as far as these SOEs are concerned. Issues of governance and you name it. And I saw that there are some recommendations there, but till when are we going to be really moving around through these state-owned enterprises? I wouldn't say get rid of them, but what do you think could be the solution? Because they just don't seem to be improving. Year after year, they're always part of the problem. And then finally, the issue of reduction of the ceiling, of the expenditure ceiling. I just want to find out. I think it's a good thing because also even the chief procurement officer was telling us about the plans that they're having to try and reduce expenditure. But the choice of the areas, I was just looking at the fact that the bulk of the reduction extended reduction is on transfers and conditional grants. Not that it shouldn't be, but I'm just looking at the fact that it is the bulk, and in my mind I'm just thinking that that is an error that actually needs this fund. What informs this decision? Is it because they are underspending or something like that? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Mine, Sheikh Imam touched on it earlier on, and I think the answers I still received a bit half. So I think if they can just maybe try to respond as to the question that I'm going to ask, because Honourable Sheikh has also alluded to it halfly, but it was answered but half done and stuff. Because the Parliament Budget Office has presented challenges shared to us in the reporting and coordination on the MTSF targets by departments. So Treasury, in terms of what are you going to do, recording to this coordination and reporting. Also, the information currently that we're having is of 2015-2016 and nothing of 2016-17. So in light of this, how do we make sense of the 2017 appropriations? For me, it's almost like giving money, buying a car, and you haven't seen it. You understand my point? I think you have also said it's purposely done like that, but if we are talking about all of this radical transformation and we're not going to transform how we are doing things and on our systems, this radical economic transformation will sort of just be a buzzword and it will fade away. We need to transform also how we do our work as Parliament. So in terms of that, if you can maybe enlighten us on. And then on the presentation slide three, I'm just a bit very fluid, Chair, so I'm not myself today. Investing in research and development and innovation. I'm sorry. Okay, thanks, Jay. I trust you. Okay. On slide three, I think this investing in research and development and innovation have been, it has been always in the slides for the past 3 years. And yes, government always invests in these innovations, but you don't see it sort of transforming in the economy as to, because the last time I remember it was in this very same committee where I said, and you know, at UCT or at UWC we went with science portfolio where students are making cell phone batteries, and that is not transformed into the market, but we are giving as government money on all of this innovation and stuff. So when are we going to actually step up to let this innovation being transformed into our economy and we're actually making money of it? And then yet again, providing workers and poor with access to markets and social economic infrastructure. That one as well, as we are saying, we will, if I understand you or understood you correctly, if we're going to upgrade, or the minister has also alluded to your township, and he alluded to a 40 by 40. But if I see now how our townships transform, every now and again there's a ShopRite or Pick and Pay popping up, this small little centers,
And those centers are oftenly not owned by black people, and they're oftenly not owned even by women. And if we're going to talk about transforming this economy, because now your spaza shop and the person that are making that little income to support her family by baking fat cakes are, you know, she is struggling, because now ShopRite will sell that fat cakes or fat cooks by 2 rand, and that person was selling it by 3 rand. Obviously, everyone will run out to ShopRite. So that shift as well, how are we going to transform that? And not only, it shouldn't always be stagnant to talking about, it should also talk about women. How is the economy going to transform for black women? How will we get entry point to this economy so it's not so male dominant as it is right now? Thanks, Jess.
Thank you for the questions. And Honorable Dr. Fick, to be followed by Honorable Member Maynir, and then Honorable Member Manana, just a reminder, Honorable Member Shobhis Thole, and then Honorable Member Imam, and then we stop there to allow the department to respond.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. I just refer to slide number 9, which talks about, prior to the appropriation bill, 45% may be spent by departments. My question is, does it happen or is it possible that the following year the department could be allocated less than 45% of the previous year? Furthermore, why, and I know it's in the legislation, but why is the figure of 45% used? Because it's been 4 months of the year, which is a third. Why not close to 33.3%? Just the question. There's a statement on slide number 12 which is a bit concerning. The top bullet point saying that government spending is aligned with the objectives of the National Development Plan. Now, we know that for the past number of years the revenue has not been aligned to the NDP. So does that mean that we're going to get the debt gap is widening? In other words, larger debt or deficit. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I have 7 questions. Six.
Let's take 2, 3, and then I'll give you another round.
Okay. Then specifically on Vote 7, Program 6, the question of BRICS, what is allocated in the budget this year for the BRICS capital payment? And where exactly is it in the budget? Then program Vote 19, Defense, what is the surplus in the special defense account, and what amount of that surplus is committed and not committed? Vote 19, Program 2, I think sub-program 5, what is the spending in this financial year on Operation Corona? Now, it's possible through you, Chairperson, that the presenters may not have the details immediately at hand. I'd be very comfortable if they could be furnished to us in writing as soon as possible. I have 3 other specific questions, but I'll wait for your second round.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also join those who welcome the report. My first question, it was regards to the BRICS, which has been asked already. If they can just explain to us where is the budget going to come from. The second question is, there were slides that you did not touch to them, but if you can just go and you can explain to us, especially on page 26 and 28,
Thank you, Chairperson. Professor Joseph Stiglitz has hailed the BRICS formation, and he says it is going to assist as the institutions that are there are not enough to fund infrastructure. When are you going to employ the Director General for the New Development Bank, because we think it's taking too long?
Thank you very much. Honorable Sima.
Thank you, Chair. You know, we continuously talking about your budgets are aligned to the NDP. And there are, in terms of your NDP, there are certain objectives that we need to achieve. But I think you'll agree with me that what we find is that we are nowhere near achieving. We're not in line with achieving any of these objectives. And we are middle way through right now. And if you look at the reports that we've been receiving, that sounds bleak. It sounds like we're definitely not going to be achieving our targets. So I don't know if you can comment, and let me give you an example. If you talk about health, every single provincial department that appeared before this committee said that they are under budgeting, and in fact they're looking at billions of rand shortfall in the country in terms of health. So how are we going to actually reach these targets? The second thing is I want to know, what do you find are really the obstacles in terms of these departments that bring in these strategic plans to you? And I know you at some stage are scrutinizing them and things. Do you really believe and accept that this is a true account of what they're doing? Because we identified in this committee that there's very little engagement with even with some of the stakeholders, you know, even districts and things. You would find that there's been no engagement, no public meetings to identify the needs and requirements, and it's just some, I think the impression we have got now is that if you add it this year at 10 billion, then next year you'll increase it by 2% or 5%, and then next year you're just working on a figure, but not really going out there and planning based on the needs. And then finally, do you believe that the different structures are talking to each other, or they were really working in silos? The provincials, the national, the local authorities, do you find that there is meaningful engagement where they are coming together? Now, some of the objectives you want to achieve, if you take from a school level, basic education must work with health, must work with sports and recreation. Now, I want you to tell, you think they are working? Because our impression is that everybody is doing their own thing, and that's why it's much more difficult to even achieve anything that we're looking for. Let me stop this.
With your permission, the Honourable Minister strongly emphasized building a capable state and a developmental public service to deal with all these anomalies, these deviations from your PFMA, from your Treasury regulations, from your Intergovernmental Relations Act. Now, what I want to find out from you as this department, do you have a monitoring and evaluation unit that is well-resourced? Because partly we have these problems, because all the monitoring and evaluation units cutting across all three spheres of government, they don't seem to be effective. They don't seem to be effective, starting from National Treasury. And if you have, what training program do you have? Because then it means the need to be trained. And that training would also have to start with the very same department planning, monitoring, and evaluation. We had them in last week. We did not get what we wanted to get from them, which then made us to conclude that maybe they don't even know what to do. Yes? We did not get what we wanted. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. So I think that would be my question to you. So can you then respond to all the questions asked? Then I give members the last round. They will have an opportunity for follow-up questions and the last round of new questions. Then we close the business between ourselves. By the way, I should have also congratulated you for the trust. To act, it means, you know, promises. There was some trust, you know, that put on you. So I pray that you, you know, I know that God will be, with God's wisdom, you will be able not to disappoint the minister.
Thank you very much. And I believe this committee will obviously help us navigate through the difficult issues that confronting this implementation of the budget. I'm just going to briefly, Michael will talk about many of the issues. I just want to touch on the issues of transformation and not even deviate from what the Minister of Finance said in his presentation of the February budget. When you look at it, it's no different from what Minister Gigaba is continuing saying in terms of what is critical and what it means for us when you talk about radical economic transformation. Chapter 1, page 9 and 10 of the budget review is a summary of what we think transformation is. And we've articulated it pretty clear. And what exactly will we do, or the changes that we need to achieve radical economic transformation. And we've listed them, all of them, in page 9 of chapter 1 of the budget review. And we selectively are picking up some bullets there that are critical: improving education and skills development, strengthening competition laws where necessary, increasing private sector participation dominated by public enterprises and ensuring effective regulatory authorities, providing support and incentive for labor-intensive sectors, overcoming special fragmentation of South African cities so that people have got easier access to jobs and infrastructure. Now, when you flip quickly to what we said in the speech, which is also very, very critical in terms of what the Minister of Finance said in February. It therefore doesn't put you in a situation where it becomes a bit hazy in terms of what it meant. Firstly, there are special challenges that you must address. In particular, Minister of Finance today gave an example about the BRICS city. As an example, in the commerce in KZN. Because when you look at the project itself, it's actually breaking the barriers or breaking the special, apartheid special planning or township planning by bringing services closer to the people, the transport net, the service delivery, the shopping, and the housing in one small locality whereby people connect, and then as a result, economic activity can be boosted. Now, that's radically different from how we've been approaching funding, as an example. In the Treasury, for instance, for the last couple of years, we came up with the city support project because we realized the importance of cities as centers of economic growth. And I'm not talking about these cities. I'm talking about new developmental cities that are critical in bringing communities together, recognizing that obviously there's geographical distance and so on. But what we've been saying, for instance, if you look at the human settlements budgets and approaches to budget, is that how, you know, the catalytic project that they are talking about, I'm talking about the Human Service, Human Settlements Department, what comprises, what makes up this catalytic project? Is it a Department of Housing or is it a Department of Human Settlements? If it's Human Settlements, it brings all services together. The whole, so for me, I think those things, if you look at private sector participation of black people in the mainstream economy, Minister talked about making sure that the 500 billion that we're spending in the public procurement, we create opportunities for black participation. I think that for me also is a good example of what's coming. And these are not different things from how inclusive
communities should we be starting to build? And we've interchangeably, by the way, and you've seen this in the last 5 weeks when the minister started engaging as new Minister of Finance, whereby there's always been a connection of what has always been inclusive growth and radical economic transformation, and trying to say we are talking almost the same thing here. But I think we must recognize that the inclusive growth has to be radical in the way we advance specific targeted and designated groups, and we must acknowledge that. And I think this budget documentation and the budget that we are presenting to you is beginning to address some of those challenges that we've seen before. And township economies, if that's the area of focus and that's the start, we should actually be looking at our townships and the structure and addressing it. Look at each individual ward, if it means that, including rural areas, what type of unemployment, the kind of interventions that we need. There was another question about business and business participation and whether business comes to the party. I think we have demonstrated in the last 18 months that it is possible. And we've led this from the front as treasury. And the minister continued doing that, including last night when he engaged very closely with black business in this case. We started, the president set up the CEO initiative last year. We spent lots of hours in terms of engaging with business to see how best we can ensure that business confidence is boosted, to ensure that business, including labor, works together to actually deliver what we have to do. And I think we've seen two big commitments that I think we should leverage on and actually move on. The SMME fund, business has put together $1.6 billion, and the challenge is for us as government on how do we ensure that the targeted groups in terms of the original intention of the fund is put together to ensure that we actually address what we need to. The second is what is presently in the cooking pot, which is the YES initiative, Youth Employment Services, where we are seeing again, there's a box in chapter one of the budget review, where we're talking in briefly giving a synopsis of what the CEO initiative was doing. The YES initiative aims at giving 1 million young people an opportunity to taste how it's like to work in a formal environment. So I think those two examples tell you that if there's commitment and there's a push from both sides, we can come to the party. And Labour came to the party in terms of the process in NetLab, for instance, to ensure that they agreed to the extension of the employment tax incentive. There was no opposition because there was great support. And I think more is needed in terms of how and when Labour should come into the party. So I think all we can do is to advance some of these things that we started some time ago to ensure that we do what we have to do and boost this economy to levels where we want it to be. Because the reason we are in a tight fiscal situation like we are right now is because there are not enough tax revenues coming. The committee, not only today, but in all the committees that I've attended, Honourable Imam has always indicated the issue about spending, taxes that are being collected and money not well spent, accountability, etc. All of those conversations are critical and for us to take forward. Just briefly, and I know Michael will talk more about this, in terms of monitoring, if you look at our own reform when we started back then in the 90s, we stabilized generally provincial and municipal finance in the early stages, including stabilizing national department's budget. As we were doing that, we did not have a department called Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation. The PFMA and the MFMA, when you look at it, called for some type of monitoring. The Treasury played that role in the early stages, between 1999 and, say, around 2004. Where we attempted to do the two, provide budgets, follow the budget, including wanting to see if the school is really built or if the road has been constructed or not. But then realization came through in government to set up the Department of Performance Monitoring Evaluation. I said to the committee before that this is a fairly new department if you think about it. 5 years, 10 years is too short a period for the department to really be at a point where we can comfortably say they are on a like on a treadmill when they are really moving. The issue here for us, I think, we don't have that unit in the treasury that does performance monitoring evaluation. We only have a unit that looks at treasury only performance. That's the difference. For the monitoring of the whole of government from a performance management point of view, the Department of Performance Monitoring Evaluation is there. And I think we need to ensure that we continuously engage the two of us with them and continuously ensure that we don't only give money and look the other way. We give money jointly with them and the expertise that they have, follow through and see where the money is. Finally, Chair, on this, the committee will realize that a few months ago, we came to the committee with a public expenditure review, and that was kind of a synopsis of what's possible if we work together and with the department, identifying areas that can unlock resources if need be, or even inform us whether we must stop certain programs or expand on certain programs. So that's what expenditure reviews are. And we believe the DPME department has a sense of ensuring that we are able to do that effectively and efficiently in a way that we recognize that the shortcomings in the whole of government. So I think most of the things I said are things that we are aware, they are in our radar, and critical for us in terms of our mindset in implementation of the budget. And as a last statement, Chair, is to recognize that it is a radical economic transformation, inclusive growth, broad-based economic empowerment, improving the lives of ordinary people, changing people's lives, changing apartheid special parts. All of those is one milieu of issues that I think we must be able, as government, all of us, we should be concerned about and actually ensuring that we have a different South Africa come tomorrow. And obviously at the center of that is fighting issues of corruption, maladministration when need be, and so on. And so on. All those things is a package, and I think the budget that we have, that we presented, especially Chapter 1, gives you a synopsis of where we want to go in terms of this current MTF budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are you ready? Can we have...
Honourable members, maybe some other questions I can also address. So I think on the question of what is radical economic transformation, I think my colleague has spoken, but I would just add that as a concept, radical economic transformation didn't only come this year. In fact, if you look at the MTSF, the government's medium-term strategic framework, the first chapter of that document is dealing exactly with what is radical economic transformation, and it frames the whole MTSF. So I think obviously there is some level of impatience and desire for things to move faster in the country, which is also reflected in many of the questions we're discussing here. And I think there's a new sense of urgency around that matter. But of course, we are also in a particular place in the political calendar, and some of these debates are the kind of debates that we should be welcoming in a noisy democracy. The question of state-owned companies is one of great concern to us, particularly the need to improve governance of the state-owned companies, and we would only... share the concerns that have been raised in the committee. On the expenditure ceilings and the reduction in the expenditure ceiling, I would also, for additional information, again refer the Honourable Member to page 53 of the budget review, where we detail, there's a table there where we detail exactly where we've reduced expenditure across the three spheres of government. And it's true that transfers and subsidies take a substantial proportion. You know, in my view, we've reached a stage where there are no easy deliverables when it comes to spending reduction. Everything you do is a choice of different unpalatable options. There's nothing there that... Ideally, we would like to say, here's a program that is not performing, that is not delivering. We can close it down and there won't be any effect on anyone. But the truth is that even that program, when you close it down and you're convinced it's not performing and it's not delivering, somebody will be affected by that cut. So wherever you go in the budget, you're faced with these difficult choices. One of the things, so we try and find areas that are less painful. Everything is painful, but we want the areas that are less painful. So some we look, for example, we don't want to cut infrastructure budgets that are there to provide development of local communities. But we observe that in those budgets that sometimes there can be a high level of underspending, which then sends the message, if you cut it, like, so if you had a budget to build 100 houses, but you underspend every year and you're only building 50 houses a year, then if we cut your budget in half, you will still be building 50 houses a year as you were before. So you don't actually have an impact on it. So that's part of the logic that we look for things, we try and look for things like that. And of course, that's a very simplistic example that I gave you, but just to illustrate the kind of logic. We also looked at public entities that had accumulated large surpluses that are uncommitted. And we said, since you've it's not a bad thing necessarily to accumulate this large surplus, but since you have this cushion, we can reduce the transfers to those public entities for a couple of years. So The thing is if you don't cut the one thing, then you will have to cut another thing. And as I say, all of the choices are difficult. But also, I wouldn't argue that we have been perfect in what we've done. And there couldn't be a better way to do the same thing. I think a lot of the questions are about the relationship between what we budget for and what are the outcomes that we're achieving. And then... what are the government systems that are acting to ensure that those outcomes are achieved? And in my view, we are at a point where really the key, you know, so one honourable member mentioned the budget is aligned to the NDP, but we're not seeing the impact. And I think this is really the issue for us, is that the issue... It would be nice and easy if we could just shift budgets to achieve change. But actually change needs organizations that are effective, that spend those budgets effectively. And the main, I mean, we do have a fiscal constraint. The fiscal constraint does impose a large burden on society. But really the critical challenge we face, in my view, is to make the money we do have more effective. And it goes for any category of expenditure. So we would usually say we should spend on capital. Spending is good because it generates growth. But if you spend on capital, it's possible to spend money on capital that doesn't generate growth. You can build a wall or a bridge. You can build a bridge across a river which has no roads connected to it, where nobody is going. Nobody is going to cross. Nobody wants to cross the river there, but you build a bridge there. You've spent the money, and you've employed some people to build the bridge in the meantime. That's a good thing. But once you finish building the bridge, you haven't made any change to the lives of anybody. So where you locate the bridge, on the other hand, you can build a bridge, say, between Alex and Santon over there, the M1 in Johannesburg, which will change people's lives directly and make it easier for people to have that access to infrastructure in Santa. And then, so the same bridge for the same cost generates two radically different impacts on society. And this is the area where we really need to improve how we do things. The same goes for research and development. You know, it's a bit like this capital spending. You can spend lots of money on research,
into issues that are not important. Also, once you've done the research, even if it's important, then converting that research into a usable technology that will be taken up by the market and which is needed is not a simple thing. And I think it's a bit broader question that I wouldn't have the expertise, and I'm sure Department of Science and Technology has whole, I'm sure there are PhDs, many of them, on this exact question that the member is raising of, how do you ensure that your research and development effort actually does generate the economic impact that you would like it to have? As my colleague has mentioned, the whole creation of the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation has meant that a lot of the functions that were previously done by Treasury in terms of the strategic plans and the APPs and the monitoring and evaluation have shifted there. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but certainly it does raise an issue of coordination and how we ensure that the budgets and the performance are aligned in some way. Incidentally, I was looking, if you do go to the ENE, we do include the performance information there to help members to engage with this relationship between budgets and performance. And I was looking at the Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services, which has three performance indicators. The first, I'm not sure how we agreed to include it, is the number of ICT position papers developed for international engagements per year. It's not a very good performance indicator. So they have a target of 5 last year and then 4 this year. I'm not sure. But members need to engage in this type of thing and criticize. But that's only one. The other ones are the questions you were asking about. So the next one is the number of identified government institutions connected as part of the national broadband plan. And you see, so they have a specific target of 2,700 government institutions connected this year. Of course, you would have to ask the department how far they're going on that one. So lastly, or I think on the issue of 45%, my assumption is that the drafters of the legislation, in this case the PFMA, were erring on the side of generosity, let me put it like that, so that we shouldn't find ourselves in a position where government comes to a halt because there's some legislative delay or something like that. So, I mean, Raquel, you want to add something?
Perhaps just to add that the budget will grow every year. So 45% of the previous budget is probably equivalent to 38% of the current budget in a constrained budget. In times where there was, you know, where the budgets were growing a lot faster than it would have been there.
So, I mean, it's something, I don't think there would be an ideal. We could always debate which is better, but so far it seems to have worked. So we haven't seen a problem on that. On the question, the specific questions of Honourable Member Mania, I think we can agree that if he provides us with the details, we can forward to the committee the answers to those questions rather than making a mistake now. I mean, I'm not sure what Operation Corona is myself, so we would need to. We would certainly be happy to provide that information. Okay, that's fine.
It's just by way of clarification, ma'am. I did send an email to yourself via the secretary last week asking these same questions, and so they're already on record with your office. So they're there already. So
just
well, my apologies. I was not aware. But we will certainly follow it up and make sure that we rectify that oversight. I think, Honourable Chair, I mean, we may not have answered every question specifically. Some of them, I think, so the whole issue of women and access to markets is important. But in a sense, I don't have a specific answer to say. I would agree that it needs a focus. So, thank you very much.
Well, so as I
said, so we have the Department of Planning, Monitoring, and Evaluation. So we, and as DDG Mohodani has said, we don't have, we are not responsible anymore for monitoring and evaluation in government. There's a department that does that, and it's one of the departments that has grown very rapidly and has quite an adequate budget. And I think sometimes what I would counsel or advise is that it would be useful to call Treasury and that department together when we have these meetings, because we can also, it forces us to compare notes and align, because it's also, it becomes easier. I don't want us to blame them and then they come and they blame us and it becomes a ping pong. I mean, not that we do that, but that's the temptation. But if we're both there in the room, then at least we'll cover everything.
If you do that, I'm sure the Secretariat is noting this. Okay. That's fine. Honourable members, do you have follow-up questions?
Chair, I was asking you to allow Honourable Manir to say his questions, even if they don't answer. But I would like to know his questions. He usually asks very good questions.
But if you recall, I said after follow-up questions, I'll give you another round, and I promised him that I'll bring him in at that stage. All right. As a follow-up question from me, on your budget expenditure reduction, yes, we understand the rationale given for those budget cuts or expenditure reduction. But our concern is, as you take a decision to reduce, we have found that at that moment, even if, say, the department had delayed in the implementation, or in the spending of the, but at the moment when you cut, you find that they're already ready to proceed, and you cut. To give a practical example, I think I've asked the Treasury, you'll remember, I've asked this question. Your water and sanitation. If they have a program, it has got to be monitored. And also, they cannot be excluded from doing whatever within the parameters of the law. But where you decided to cut the budget, they were ready to run with your bucket eradication. And you cut. Unless I am misquoting, but I know that they were ready. We asked them, why is this cut? Because for time immemorial, we've been talking about bucket eradication. And then now that there's this department, it could be that they've been slow with their designs and maybe trying to understand the systems and putting things, in place so that they can implement. But at the time when you cut, we got the impression that they were ready to implement, but then the budget was cut. And then, on the other hand, the buckets have not been eradicated, and they're not going to be eradicated. We're even talking about sanitation at schools. Schools are without toilets. And even if we can't understand who, between Minister of Water and Sanitation and Basic Education, but there are no toilets, but we know there's money for infrastructure development. There are no toilets. So, to me, that's key, So, can you, I don't know if you can find an innovative way of trying to look at the next step. Even if they're late, maybe you can punish them by giving them a warning. That's still a punishment. So, if by this you don't, this budget will be cut. So that at least this service does not suffer. They still continue to render the service because to me it's key. I have been to those schools where they are, I can't even hide talking about it, where they are drop toilets. They're even overflowing. I mean, what type of an environment is that one for learning? And whilst kids go, maybe find an alternative place, they will walk to that distance, the classes will continue this side. By the time the child comes back to the classroom, he will have missed so much, or she will have missed so much. So it's not healthy. So I'm just there, where you cut. And I know you'll be so reasonable. I'm not saying you must not cut, but where, when you look, you can see that this program, in the next financial year, is up. Going to be up and running, then you at least, and you see this one is, to me, it's priority. Yeah? Honourable Member?
Thanks, Chair, and I fully agree the proposal of letting the Department of Monitoring come together with Treasury so we can iron out some of the issues and stuff. And exactly on your point of the cutting as well, I think, yes, before the cutting as well, your reasons for cutting, and then as well, when you are cutting, because Chair has made a proposal based on the water and sanitation issue, but it's in that exact department that year on year they are coming that there are corruption, that are underspending in certain programs and so forth. So if we can also, you know, sort of be more I don't know which word to use, but having more to put our foot down sort of a way, and you have put it in your proposal as well, the respect for the rule of law and transparent government and so forth. So if that as well, that aspect, we really have to put our foot down, regardless of whether you are going to be the department known, as you are already known, as the unfavorable department, but you have to put your foot down. And these individuals that are misspending and are just eating the money unashamedly should really have to go to jail and really have to spend their time in jail, or even at these community projects in schools and stuff like that. Because kids are dying, falling into pit toilets on a daily basis. Women are being raped. They're going to a river and getting water. So really we need to start strengthening our rule of law. And in terms of how people are using the government money, yeah. And then the one I asked you earlier on I don't think you've answered me fully, on the one on women within the transformation process. And I would understand it, maybe perhaps if you don't have some of the information offhand, I would really like if you can maybe send something to our secretary on that, because I think it's an issue that we shouldn't underplay or sort of let it get lost in our way of dialogue, in our way of how we are transforming the economy, because women have been left behind in so many times in when we are saying we are talking about transforming the economy and so forth, and it's always just been male dominant. So we need to really take a standpoint as to, in this transformation that we are talking about, where are we going to picture women within this transformation? That we, it needs to be very specific. We can't, it shouldn't, and it should never be, and women should never be allowed that it be underplayed and always be, just be the typist. So we really need to really have a way on that. Thanks, Jess.
I think those are follow-up questions. Maybe we should put even the new questions together and then we allow this. If you've got new questions, this is your time. Honourable Member Menir, am I pronouncing your surname correctly?
Not quite correct, Chair.
Okay.
It's close and it's getting better, but it's main year.
It's main year.
Yeah.
Well, you know why I'm asking? Because I listened to Mr. Fek. So I thought maybe you were wrong, I was correct, but yours was correct. Main year, yeah. Okay, so we all know now, eh? Okay, thanks. Over to you.
Something I believe that drives runs on backs. A mania. Chair, just three follow-up questions. Michael did touch on the whole question of the new division of labor between DPME and National Treasury. Michael did touch on the new division of labor between DPME and National Treasury. I wonder if he could just give us some more particulars. Because from the outside, it looks like, and I might be wrong in this, that DPME now have a greater role in the budget process, and that that role comes at the expense of National Treasury. I wonder if we could just, if they could explain it to us. I think it's very important. The second question relates to the whole question of post-school education on page 9 of the longer document. I wonder if Michael could just take us through that. My understanding, if I read correctly, and I might be reading incorrectly, that in fact in this financial year there's a decrease in expenditure on higher education and then a significant increase in 18-19-19-20, and that those funds, which is an 11 billion rand increase over the MTF, are clawed back somehow from the National Skills Fund. I wonder if you could explain, so that there's no real, so that it's a budget neutral, I presume, intervention. I wonder if you could explain exactly how that works and how the funds are clawed back from the National Skills Fund and what the opportunity cost of that is. I think that's important. And then finally, just another technical question, again, which we might just add to the three previous questions. On page 63 of the budget review, there's reference to employment programs and a spending envelope, I think, in this financial year of 20.4 billion. I wonder just simply if we could have a detailed breakdown of that expenditure. The reason I'm looking carefully at that is I suspect that spending on employment programs is vastly understated and is probably hidden in capital expenditure. And I'm looking for that money. What are we actually spending on these programs? Because I think, Chair, there's a claim by government that they're spending X on capital expenditure. It's, in fact, not entirely true. There's significant amounts of money under capital expenditure actually driven towards the EPW program. That's the hypothesis I'm working with. I'm hopefully can prove it in the next few weeks.
Any other new questions?
Analysts, maybe it's the acting DG, the analysts are saying much as there has been increase in social grants and in the old age pensions, the recipients are not financially better off. This made me to think than they were in 2016. As the increase has not kept pace with the inflation. So what is your take and what do you think can be done in future? Because, I mean, this is aggravated also by the downgradings. That money can't assist them, you know, to live a better life. Yeah, we should have asked the minister about the downgrading. I thought I would ask the minister, but next time. There's always next time. Okay. No, that, I think that's my question. Talking here of, remember the child support grant which increased by 20 rand to 380, and then old age pension which increased by 95 rand to 1,600. And taking into consideration that indeed, especially those children, the orphans, the age orphans, and many children or households rely on this 1,600. I'm just provoking your thoughts so that as we move forward, let's also look at how can you assist in this regard, because they have not, you know, for instance, they're just analyzing their corners. You don't want them to start protesting now, yeah, before we respond. Okay. Over to you.
The issues you raised about the cuts, and sometimes we cut when people are ready to implement and such. As a general comment, let me say that what should help us with such instances is that we try to not do these things alone as Treasury. We try to sit with the departments concerned and actually agree with them bilaterally which are the areas. And it might not work in all circumstances, and in this case there may have been some different outcome. But in general, what we present in the budget is a combination of, or is the outcome of an intense process of engagement with line departments. That being said, I wanted to ask my colleague, Mr. Stephen Kenyon, to just give some background information on, in particular, on the bucket eradication.
Michael, Chair, just to take you back in time a little bit on how that bucket eradication program grant was funded. That grant was created in 2014. And it was funded through a reprioritization. As you know, with the expenditure ceiling, there was no new money. We reprioritized funding of around 900 million per year over 2 years out of the Human Settlements Development Grant, so close to R1 billion a year over 2 years from the Human Settlements Development Grant went into that bucket eradication program grant. In the first year that funding was allocated, it was the same year that that the function was shifted to the new Department of Water and Sanitation. It was also a year in which there was a decision that the level of supply for the bucket eradication program wouldn't be VIP toilets, which was what was initially planned. It was going to be full waterborne sanitation, which meant that all the projects had to be then redesigned. There was also a parliamentary recommendation that said that the department, which was then still the Department of Human Settlements, shouldn't use its entities to implement the project because there had been a number of problems in some kind of pilot projects with that. So there were a number of challenges, and that meant that the program was underspent very heavily in that year. In the next, so there was heavy underspending in the first year. In the second year, they spent pretty well, and the program was then extended into 2016-17 with an allocation of 350 million rand, and in the adjustment budget we came and added a further amount onto that. Then in this year's budget we have not extended the grant. Instead we have said that the Department of Water and Sanitation will complete those projects through reprioritizations within their two existing grants, the Municipal Water Infrastructure Grant and the Regional Bulk Infrastructure Grant. And the reason that we said they would do that is because of the nature of the projects has changed so substantially, where most of the individual units at households have been constructed that were planned, and the major missing piece now is the bulk and reticulation infrastructure. So it's not about a per-household bucket eradication anymore. It's about bulk service provision wastewater treatment works upgrading, which would normally be funded through mainly the regional bulk infrastructure grant. And if I can just relate this also, because it links very neatly with the discussion we were having also about the cuts to conditional grants and how they were targeted. You'll remember we took that money out of the Human Settlements Development Grant. What that meant was that there was R1 billion each year taken out of the Human Settlements Development Grant, and then a big increase in the outer year. And that increase in the outer year landed in 2017-18. So when we came, as Michael said, looking for, we had to make these reductions for the expenditures, the lowering of the expenditure ceiling. And we had this jump. The planned expenditure in the Human Settlements Development Grant was going to jump from $18.3 billion last year to $21 billion this year. And we said, given that there are problems in several departments, in several provinces with implementation, et cetera, there's no way that that is going to, that's not plausible. So we'd rather make a reduction, and the largest single reduction to a conditional grant then was on the Human Settlements Development Grant. And I know that when they presented to you, the FFC raised this as an alarming thing that we took $1.2 billion out of the HSDG. But when you say it like that, we took $1.2 billion out of the HSDG, it sounds very dramatic. But what actually happens in the HSDG is that it goes from $18.3 billion in 2016-17 to $19.9 billion this year. And then it continues to grow to $21 billion next year, $22.3 the year after. So there's still steady growth in the Human Settlements Development Grant. There is similarly growth of at least 5% per year in all of the local government grants that we've made reductions on. So we've tried to tailor those reductions in a way that we're able to sustain the pace of delivery that was already happening on the ground. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, when you asked about this question, you actually said children are falling into latrine toilets somewhere, and here is the money that we have cut back, you know, using whatever English and accounting terminology. But I just want to imagine, what does it mean to you when you are seated in your office and you hear that children are falling into a toilet latrine, and you know that you have cut this money? Does it come to your mind that I must quickly do something about that school, or do you wait until another child has fallen into the same latrine? You know, because we need to be human in this thing. And to me, transformation is speaking to our souls as we work, you know. As we work, we're not working with toys. We're working with human beings who have been disadvantaged, tortured by life, maybe since they were born. And as South Africa, we want to go forward. That is why, Mina, I don't hate the noises. When you said noisy democracy, I don't hate these noises. I think it's a wake-up call that some people are feeling pain somewhere, and we need to change the way we do things. I hear all those things. You know, I come from an accounting background. I hear all the terminology. But I must also apply my person. If it was my child who has fallen into that toilet, would I still be sitting, speaking in British English here? Or would I be crying in Shangan? You know, I think that is what we must try to speak to ourselves.
No, that's fine. I'm sure you can hear the underlying message. The very strong one. So they say, let's get out of our comfort zone. Yeah? And not theorize. I think we've done it enough. We want to see
Thanks, Jay, and I wanted to entertain this thing a little bit further. I think we shouldn't, it should also be on the ones that are stealing the money and the fraudsters, because I remember, Chair, when we were in Paddy, and I raised it in this committee, when I was deployed in Paddy for political work on that toilet corruption that has happened in the Amatola region. And we shouldn't address this one in exception to the corruption that is happening within these departments where these programs is happening. I think we should address the one of Treasury and of saying, okay, if kids have fallen into a toilet, yes, your processor, you can't give money, but how are you going to also do with the ones that are frauding and the corruption that is happening in some of these areas? They must also now start to have a little conscience and be punished for their deeds, for those kids, and held responsible for those kids that are falling into a pit toilet. To go in those toilets, it's very traumatizing. It was traumatizing for me. It was my first encounter last year with those type of scenario, and it's traumatizing for me. It was traumatizing. Imagine for a kid, 6-year-old kid, that must go into that on a daily basis. So we should never speak about this issue in isolation to those ones that are frauding the money of those toilets. That is my standpoint on this issue.
I still stick to what I have said. The defrauding is not the duty of Treasury. It's ours as members. What are we doing? What are we doing? We must not exonerate ourselves from this responsibility. The Constitution is very clear. The oversight is our job. I am talking about the allocation. It's a different thing. On the oversight, you and I must be on the, we must remove ourselves from this tea room air conditioning and go on oversight on the site. I've said it several times. That is a different scenario. Thank you.
As long as you promise that as you continue, your voices will not be higher. Continue to
many other areas where I'm sure if you carefully apply your mind, even in that consultation with the relevant department, yeah? But at the end, I think as Treasury, you must take the final decision. You have the authority, depending on the most, what you see as the priority, yeah? In that discussion. What is priority? Now we are trying to say as this committee, as part of our work, we're saying, can you please look at those that are already at an implementation stage and then look at whether you cannot give those a last chance. If even in the Bible, we are given the last chance, second chance. But then with a condition to say, if you fail on this one, we're taking it definitely.
But then you remember I raised the monitoring and evaluation. To me, it's an alternative solution. Because we can't wait until at the end of the financial year to discover these things and then we want to cut, want to punish. Now, I'm saying at DG, and I want to argue that your department should have a monitoring and evaluation. Because remember the in-year monitoring that you do, it's on the expenditure. So that's the unit that I'm talking about. Maybe on a quarterly, not even quarterly basis, say 6 months, because you will have given them enough time to implement the conditional grant. If you look in terms of their expenditure in 6 months' time and you can see that these people are lagging behind, then I think that's where you've got to intervene. Because in your mind, you should emphasize service delivery as well. You want to see this money being used for the purpose for which it was budgeted for. So 6 months' time, maybe you, either you call them, remember those outreach that you did, you identify those and you go straight to them and say to them, they must explain and you want an accelerated plan. You put pressure on them. You want an accelerated plan so that you can see, you know, it's an accelerated plan that will assist with the implementation of that program and the implementation of that budget before the end of the financial year. 6 months, 12 months, you know. 6 months, I think, is fair. If they give you that accelerated plan, you will then monitor them on that accelerated plan. Only where they are not moving fast enough with the budget implementation, especially on the conditional grants. So you must be preoccupied with, you want to see them using it and not to wait to take it because you want to, you know, redirect it to where you think it's best needed. But because it was budgeted for, so it must implement that financial year. And then, of course, consequence management. You see, if you monitor, you go there and you monitor, then you'll be able to identify all those issues that need consequence management. And then you act on them at that stage. So that the people on the ground don't suffer. Those that have been employed to do the work, they do the work. If they fail, there must be consequence management. Doesn't matter whether that person is close to me or close to you, just become, you apply maximum objectivity and you apply consequence management. Come again?
I think we need the political will in terms of consequence.
No, I'm sorry. This is an admin. This is an admin matter. No,
they can.
It's not elections. Don't worry. It's an administration matter. The DG. That's why the DG is accountable. Not the. They didn't say the politician. He's an overseer. The DG must make sure that the program is implemented to the letter, and there are no deviations, and there's compliance all the way. All right. Now we're handing over to you to help us to close. Because, you see, the voices are...
So, there are a number of other questions, Chair. I don't know if
okay,
I should go
please,
through all of them.
Please.
But before that, I think it's important to say that, you know, I mean, some of the debate here, people have... You as a committee, members of Parliament, you're democratically elected representatives of South African citizens. And you have a role to play. And we are not that. We are professionals with skills that are making a contribution to do what the minister was saying of building this developmental capable state. And what we try and do when we come here is honestly engage in facts. So when we're asked a question about a particular issue, and we respond by putting a set of facts on the table. If we're then confronted with a sentiment that says the language in which you are putting these facts doesn't speak to my heart, and even almost going as far as saying, are you not human to consider that children are dying as a result of something? That's a very serious allegation. And it's fine, I'm not saying it shouldn't be made, but what it will do is it will result in us being reluctant
because we're expecting with our accounting professions, with our economic profession, with our financial profession that we've been trained in, to engage in these debates, that we would come here and put facts and then those facts would be engaged. But if we're not if the facts are not being engaged, but instead we're being subjected to some kind of emotional questioning of our humanity, it will make us more reluctant or hesitant to come and honestly, forthrightly put the facts on the table. So I think that's important to state. On the question of women in transformation, I agree it's very important. I think I've mentioned either in a joint committee or in the Appropriations Committee before that we're trying to work with the Department of Women on a gender lens to analyze the budget through. Gender budgeting is a very important way that we could ask difficult questions of the budget that need to go beyond, in my view, you know, there's a danger of confining transformation to being about business opportunities. And business opportunities and procurement and these kind of things are important. But we need a much broader view, particularly on gender, given that the majority of women the truth is that only a minority is likely to ever benefit from business opportunities. But there's a range of government programs that we need to look at, including in the healthcare sector, including in the security sector, and how we're dealing with rape, and are we allocating sufficient budgets there within the police, in the social grant sector, the child support grants, and the issues you yourself were raising. Those are the kind of gender questions that we should be posing in a gendered approach to budgeting. And I think as Treasury, we're very ready to go down that path in partnership with the Department of Women. On the question posed about the relationship between DPME and National Treasury in the budget process, I don't think it's correct that Honorable Mania was saying that this is a subtraction from Treasury's role. In the in the 2000s, there was an institution located within the presidency called PCAS, the Presidential Coordination and Advisory Services. And each year, that institution would prepare a strategy document that updates the MTSF. And gives a sense of direction to the budget process of what are the key priorities that we need to focus on the next process. Now, for better or for worse, PCAS is no longer there. There's now a DPME. And we have raised with the DPME in several budget processes that we think the budget process would benefit from a more focused set of priorities. Because one of the challenges we have as government is we have too many priorities. So we've asked DPME on several occasions that if we could come into the process with a focused priority paper, that would help to give focus to the budget process. So it's not that it's taking away something from Treasury. It's re-establishing this link between planning and budgeting. Because if you don't have a plan, as they say in public finance, your budget becomes the plan. So we need much more effective planning in order for there to be more effective budgeting, and that's essentially the role that DPME we hope it will play. On the Department of Higher Education and Training and the allocation in the first year, I would refer honourable members to page 52 of the budget review, where it says, in consultation with the Department of Higher Education and Training, government agreed to use the National Skills Fund's reserves to fund the shortfall in university education in 2017-18. And there's a table there showing that $4.998 billion is intended to be drawn down from the National Skills Fund to fund the shortfall both in NSFAS and on university balance sheets arising from the zero fee increase in the first year, 17-18. But it's important to understand that these costs always carry through. So whatever you do in one year, it will recur in the following years. So they're covering the first year. In the second year and the third year, The fiscus is covering the shortfall through the cuts and the other things that we've announced every year. So it isn't a question of them deploying funds and then we clawing it back. It's a question of them covering the first year using their accumulated surplus, and in the future years, Treasury is picking up the tab for the recurring costs. So in our discussion with them, the conclusion was that this was an unencumbered reserve that they had, which was significantly bigger than $5 billion. So they have some programs and projects that they were intending to do, which may suffer as a consequence, but they had not made concrete commitments on those programs, so those resources were available for deployment. So again, going back to page 52, it says the carry-through costs of these shortfalls, which is $5.3 billion in 18-19 and $5.7 billion in 19-20, are funded from other sources. In addition, government has made $5 billion provisional allocation to the higher education sector in 1920. So in the first year, they've put $5 billion on the table. In the second year, we have put $5 billion. In the third year, we've put $10 billion. So net-net, I suppose if you wanted to see it like that, there isn't a subtraction from the sector. But this was more a pragmatic approach to the problem that in the first year, we were very, as I said, we're always very reluctant to cut budgets at short notice. Also because of the issues that have been raised by the chair around budget eradication, it's much better to cut in a few years' time than it is to cut now, because then you give people a chance to think about how they will respond to that cut. On the employment program, there is a table on page 63 of the budget review which gives a line for the employment program. There are, I'm not sure what Honorable Mania is planning, and I hope I don't live to regret this, but there are serious accounting issues with how you account, I mean, fundamental issues that even the accountant general and the accounting profession is grappling with, that how do you account for, how do you classify these payments, which are they wages, are you purchasing goods and services, are you purchasing capital equipment? There is an issue there which is not it's like a bit of a technical problem that I know the accountant general is applying his mind to. And lastly, on the social grants, I think the issue we have, remember, is that when we announce an increase in social grants at the beginning of a year, we don't know what the inflation rate is going to be for that year. We only have an estimate. So we might think that inflation this year is 6%, and then we raise grants by 6%. And then at the end of the year, we find that inflation was 5%. Then it means we've raised them by more in real terms than we had intended. Alternatively, we might come to the end of the year and find that inflation is 7%, which means that it's less. So what the approach we take is we try not to look at individual years. We look at from a base year of 2012. We have social grants over the whole period from the base year kept pace with inflation. And if we see, looking back, that they have not kept pace with inflation, we will give a little bit extra. Alternatively, if we see that they've exceeded inflation, we'll give a little bit less. So in our view, social grant values have kept pace with consumer price inflation over the last 5 or 10 years, as well as accommodating a massive increase in recipients. On the other hand, it's not necessarily the case that makes everything fine, because there's many different inflations that different sections of the population face, and CPI is an average. So the question of whether we should have some more explicit linkage between price increases that are facing the recipients of social grants and the budget is an important question that should be subject of debate.
Acting DG, do you want to add?
No, thank you very much. I just want to add on the part of DPME, also just add a little bit of what Michael said. And also, in the team that I had in public finance, we've got about 100 or so plus budget analysts. These are guys who sit on a daily basis, engage the numbers and the spending and anything that goes to them in department. And these are the guys who produce the quarterly reports that this committee interacts with on a quarterly basis. You know, the document that we've been grappling with over the number of years, and now we've improved it. And for us, it should lift the issues up. And I guess maybe, with your indulgence on this one, and I've tried to bring it across to the committee. For us, it's to lift these issues up. For the committee to engage with the relevant department. And also for the committee, if it deems fit, to call a joint committee, both the appropriations and the select committees, both in the NCOP and the NA, and call, if it means the relevant province, let it come here. If it means the relevant province, let it come here. But for us, where we sit, and with due respect, to be able to know that toilet in oak guards in breadth, where I come from, it's a bit difficult. Because the municipality, the treasurer refers in the province, the Department of Education in the province, he should come in. All we can do is to say to you, the mix spending is not, or the budget eradicating program is not performing. After 6 months, they spend 10%. We would advise the committee to call them. And the challenge has always been, at what point do we call this committee and call ourselves? But because the process is running, and the committee is edgy, and I understand, because we will leave these issues like we've lifted them up today for your purposes. But then, obviously, we wish to engage on those. And we find that we are a bit strong because we're not necessarily the right people, even though we put money across. So, in the budget bilaterals, Chair, we have DPME in the room. And they raise these issues. They also have the numbers that, from a Section 32 report on a monthly basis, as you know it, or a quarterly report, Department X or Province X spends 30% of their budget eradication program. They know that they can engage with the department. They actually, in some cases, even go to that particular province or area and see for themselves. So I think it's continuously an issue that we would want to maybe bring it much earlier in a more direct way to the committee on issues of underspending and the reasons. And then we will obviously request that the committee, and we said it, and I've said it before, that we would not mind but to be in the room when you engage that department or province or whoever you want to engage with, based on the facts that would have made available to you. So I'm still saying, Chair, I like the challenge. I like the fact that you are saying we must be urgent, the speed. We don't have time, and it's all these things that we are aware of. And that also in our budget bilaterals that we have with ongoing basis with the department, because it's more ourselves than Michael in this case, that the team in public finance should on and as they do, including provinces, where Stephen comes from, with the joint provincial treasury, to ensure that these issues are lifted up in a way that it becomes easy for you to play your oversight role, which by law, obviously, you've been playing very well up to. But I welcome the fact that you are pushing us to do more, let our analysis that we do, our engagements, lift the issues and be more agile and ask the relevant questions. We've given you money, what have you done? And then we can come to you and say, they told us. But the ones, the map in the room say, you did not spend because in terms of our budget, and here the minute you said you cannot for the following reason, then the committee can then engage. And then we've taken the responsibility to where it belongs. The HOD of that particular department in any particular province, including, like the minister came this morning, including the MEC in that province, who should, and by the way, in the early 2000s, that's what used to happen here. We would be called in as the provincial, as the treasury then. We put the issues and the department is in the room, the minister, the MEC, relevant MEC is in the room, and the committee engages. Because some of these issues, we have to pick them at the right level, with the right accounting officers, maybe not in our case on this. Like, if I, in closing, Chair, I can say, and
committee must wish me well because I'm going for an interview at 1:30.
on a more serious note, the committee
should hold the treasury accountable for things that we, like for instance, last week I was here with you, we were talking on this facility. That's us, you know, it's not anybody. But and we should be able to maybe help through the researchers. What areas would definitely be our issue that we should be slammed on a little bit, including those that we need to assist you to package information to engage with other departments and other HODs? Thank you.
I know that the emphasis, actually it's PSET, post school education, but the emphasis has been tertiary education at the expense of your TVET and your CET. Now, I'm just to share with you on where the other need is in that department. They have a serious budget shortfall for this financial year, the new financial year. I promise you we'll try to look and interrogate the bill to see where we can find the money. To be honest, we're still working on that one, but it's so difficult. But it's good for you moving ahead, you know, into the near future to know that this other serious area. You don't want the TVET colleges to protest like the tertiary education before they can get money. And when we say this, we're not undermining your mental integrity, you know, but we're saying, hey, let's focus into the future because there's this other pot that is boiling. And then one day, we don't want it to spill over us and find ourselves again having to deal with the students. CET, Community Education and Training. I don't know what influence would Treasury have also on the decisions made, especially on where decisions are made, but those decisions are not followed by resources. I don't know if you have influence there, because in your engagement with both the, with the executive, thinking it could also assist where decisions are taken, serious decisions taken, but there are no resources. So if you can also, just as a way of cushioning and, you know, sending word of, it's a precautionary measure. So what's the use of us having these good decisions that you can't implement because there are no resources? I know you've lowered the budget ceilings in response to the economic nosedive. I don't know, I'm sure there's another one, but which one would you use? Economic turbulences. I know you've responded, but I'm trying to say also the decisions that are taken, if you can caution on that also, because it will assist. They don't stop those decisions, but somebody must say, yes, these are quality things, but we don't have the money now. Can we keep them in abeyance until when, so until such time that we have money, then we can talk about it. So when you come up with these decisions and they're not implemented, then people then complain about government failing to implement some of the decisions that government has taken. All right. Now, I don't know. I know he's left it. Did he leave that to you? Your closing statement? That the mission of this meeting has been accomplished. We've listened to the minister for the first time. Now we know his thinking. That's why I wanted him to give us his overview. We can actually pick up his vision in his overview. And you can see he's not mincing his words in the radical socio economic transformation. The social part, that's when you empower those who don't have. And then the economy, that's when you grow the economy so that we can create jobs and then reduce poverty. And also you bridge the gap between those who have and those who have not. So you can hear he's so focused on that one. And is also sensitive to the fact that we're left with 2 years, which means we don't have time to be emotional about things. We don't have that time, that love that we don't have. And we're moving from, indeed, the technocrats can give us very nice plans, narratives. We know more there. We can see we move one impact, which is our way. Value for money. Nothing else. Now next time we just want, maybe when we engage with those, we just want to focus on value for money. What impact have you made with this budget? You know, because we want impact. And the impact is only on service delivery and bringing a better life for all. We are satisfied, we are happy, we've got the information, even where we were emotional, I've already cautioned that moving forward, let's try and control that a bit. It's called emotional intelligence. We've got to apply that, and also where there are sensitive issues. We also don't respond to those issues we rise above. We might be reluctant, I'm not quoting anybody, I quote, we might be reluctant, end quote. So we rise above all these, you know, and then continue remaining focused and assisting the committee to be more effective and efficient in its interventions. I would also like to announce that we have arranged as part of this process towards the tabling of the appropriation bill. We've arranged a public hearing in Khayelitsha on the appropriation bill. It's taking a very serious, you know, turn. There will be public education on Monday, and then we will go there, the engagement with the community, and then we've invited various stakeholders to come and, you know, and listen and engage with the bill, you know, because we will also be presenting the bill to them. I don't know if National Treasury was not invited. Was National Treasury invited? But if there's anyone from National Treasury can be available, just listen. We'll appreciate. So I had Honourable Member Shokesola saying that tea and what we are having here, it's not on, we've got to go out. And we are already ahead of you, Honourable Member Shokesola. We are out there next week Wednesday. So this has helped us to be more ready and to be able to respond to the questions that will be raised then, but also for us to consider those inputs in our report. Thank you so much, and indeed we've had constructive and meaningful engagement. Meeting between ourselves is now agenda. But then to the honourable members, we just need to do one procedural matter. That one of the declaration. As you can see, the motion of desirability 2017 appropriation bill, it is something that is prescribed. So we have to do it before, you know, we engage with the other departments, all the stakeholders that we've decided to call to come and appear before us. Thank you. Tell me, Mr. Dondo, that this committee wishes him all of the best. The interviews, okay. All right, I am going to read the declaration, and then honourable members can then adopt the declaration so that we can then proceed with our work on the appropriation today. The declaration is as follows, that in the opinion of the committee, legislation is desirable to appropriate money from the National Revenue Fund for the requirements of the state for the 2017/18 financial year, to prescribe conditions for the spending of funds withdrawn from the 2018/19 financial year before the commencement of the Appropriation Act for the 2018-19 financial year, and to provide for matters incidental to. Now, honourable members, do you agree with this declaration? Honourable member?
Thanks, Chair. I don't know, Ivo, what do one do if they don't agree with the declaration? I just wish that we had this declaration a bit earlier, because we will have to consult with our, in the case of me, I would have had to consult with my party whether to agree or not to agree. But in this case, I would not agree to it unless we get it in writing, and then I consult. Thanks, Jay.
Okay. Andy, can you help us with the section in the rules? Understand. So that we contextualize it. The rules of Okay, there's a hand. Let's just read the rules, because this is what is required of us in this process. It's still in the process, not like we are adopting, but in the process we've got to agree that we continue with the work that is before us on the appropriations bill.
Yes,
sir.
I just want to know if we can use our conscience.
No. No. Let's follow the rules. I know last time you did call for me, servants are forgotten the rules. Wait, after rule?
86.
Rule 86. So,
yeah.
26. Or 286. Can you please read so that members can understand exactly what is happening here? Can you read it out?
Chairperson?
Yes.
The motion of desirability is in terms of Rule 286, 4, I. It states as follows. After due deliberation, the committee must consider a motion of desirability on the subject matter of the bill and, if rejected, must immediately table the bill and its report on the bill. So basically, this motion of desirability is to check whether the committee is happy that it should continue with the processing of the bill. It's got nothing to do with whether you agree or not agree to the bill. It's just basically for you, for the committee to say, yes, we are happy, we are going to process the bill. And then the adoption and whether you agree to the bill or not comes afterwards. Thank you, Chair.
So it's about us continuing with the process. So this legitimizes this process so that we are all moving from the same wavelength. And then the adoption comes after. Continue, meaning that we've got to continue with the public hearings, got to continue with the departments appearing before us, and then we then write a report. Then the report, if we all agree, we adopt. And then that's the report that will be taken to the House. For now, it's about just to unleash this process, allow this process to unfold up till where we write a report, and then we then will then check with you if we adopt or we don't adopt the report. Honourable Member Shopesole?
Chairperson, my conscience say I'm happy.
Honourable Member Mashoki?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I remember correctly the way it was worded, I don't think it's right for us to say it's desirable for a bill to release money from the fiscus. It has to happen. It's not desirable. We can't say yes or no to it. It's the law. If you want to get money out of the fiscus, there has to be a bill. So we can't say whether that's desirable. We can say the process is desirable, but we can't say the bill itself is desirable because we've got no choice in the matter.
So let me read again what you said. Okay. Says motion of desirability. That, in the opinion of the committee, legislation is desirable to appropriate money from the National Revenue Fund for the requirements of the state for the 2017-18 financial year. And then it then continues to say, to prescribe that legislation is desirable to prescribe conditions for the spending of funds withdrawn for the 2018-19 financial year before the commencement of the Appropriation Act for the 2018-19 financial year, and to provide for matters incidental thereto. Okay. If we all don't understand this,
No, I'm...
you know what, the best would be, because it's very important that we have this consensus. We can then request, can Advocate Jenkins ask for this? But this is what, but for you to satisfy yourself that we are doing the right thing. But it's always best to follow the rules to the latter. So it is in the rules, it is prescribed. So we're trying to comply. But if, as I put it to you, if members are not comfortable to do this now, we can do it tomorrow. And then we ask maybe Advocate Jenkins to come and explain the importance of that. Member Dr. Fee?
Thanks. Yeah, this is not the first time we'll be doing it anyway. But can I just request then that we get a copy of that, and then tomorrow, fine, we can look at it.
Okay.
Because I agree.
Yeah.
Just thinking about now, it's just the process that we're agreeing to. The process is in terms of the rules, and I mean, there is a Money Bills Act as well. So there's a whole lot of reasons why it must continue. So I don't think we could stop it, but I think, and I will agree with Honorable Slangwini here, that we've got rules, and we just need to comply with those rules as well.
No, that's fine. Honorable Member
Shopee, I think it's good to allow members to go and consult their political, because this is a political process.
Okay. No, that's fine. I said that I will request the secretariat at the beginning to quote the rules, so that whoever picks this thing up must know where it comes from. Start with it and then say that, da-da-da-da-da-da, in terms of rule, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, then da, you know, so that it's contextualized. Okay. Thank you very much. Can
and
you
also,
please?
Chair, sorry, and it's a legal binding document, so it must say from that rule, and then is that wording going to stay the same throughout the process as well? It's also important, so that we, when we come back again next year, it's not now a different sort of scenario. So I think it's best we get it, and then it must be
standardized
properly, and then, yeah,
okay.
For tomorrow.
All right. So you will then correct it, then effect the changes that we are proposing, and then circulate it to members. But tomorrow we must finalize.
I don't think we must. That's the resolution that we must correct it. It might be right in its current form. We just need to make sure. That's all I think we say. We're not, this, again, the way I think it's not, I don't believe that it needs to be changed. We are saying that we agree with the process, not the bill. So there's two different things. All we say, from my side, I say, just make sure that the wording is correct. I don't know about it. I don't know if it's necessary to change it. Sorry.
If I may rule, you know, it contextualizes this thing. Anyone who picks up this paper might not know, might not link it with the rules, you know. So now we are saying, professionally, if they pick it up, they must know where it comes from, and if they want to satisfy themselves, they can open. But also the wedding name will stay the same. Why I'm saying this, if you look at the bill, this thing is just a declaration. It's taken from it. It's an extract from it. But I do want us to give it a background where it comes from, which is what is not written here, to say we must accept the declaration. Okay. All right then. Thank you very much. Otherwise, any correspondence? I know I've received correspondence from Honourable Member McLaughlin, which I forwarded to National Treasury. National Treasury will respond. It had a whole list of questions. And then the main reason for forwarding it, we thought they would come with those responses, but I'm sure there was a breakdown of communication. Maybe we did not say we must bring those responses yet. So this will get that. Any other correspondence?
No, Chair, I'm just saying if a member asks a question,
It would be nice if we know about that CPS colleague in there, so that when they respond, we know what they are responding at.
There's nothing wrong with it, but professionally, they would then come and say, there's this question that was asked, and then they respond.
It's okay.
This, then they respond. This, yeah. Okay. No, that's fine. Let's make our life easy. Okay. Thank you so much. We've come to the end of our meeting, and the meeting stands adjourned. Thank you very much for all your contributions.